Great Hunters, a sci-fi space opera, written by Gary Kaufman, read and produced by Andrew Kaufman. For more information about the author, book, or podcast, visit www.kaufmansci-fi.com. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Great Hunters podcast. I'm Andrew Kaufman, your host. We've got a nice full episode for you today. Last episode, we met our protagonist, Mike, and got a brief introduction to Mike's society and his future profession. This episode, we'll meet a couple more members of Mike's people and even see some of what exobiology holds for Mike's future. We'll also give you a few more clues into the society of the Elfmen and how things work for them. They aren't actually all that different from our society, except for a few things. Mainly that they are basically walking, talking trees. It'll definitely get a little more interesting in this episode. Well, we have almost 23 minutes of story, so I'll go ahead and get us into it. But before we begin, in the grand tradition of many podcast storytellers, I shall bring you the story so far. Mike, a tree-like denizen of the distant planet of Erdiu and student of the School of Exobiology, has been given the, at least him, unpleasant assignment of visiting the Garden of Exiles, the final resting place for exobiologists that violated the no-contact rule, which prohibits anyone from making any contact whatsoever with planets that they are studying. Afraid, he enters the garden, not knowing why he was actually sent there. Surprisingly, he actually meets one of the former exobiologists named Garwig, who, contrary to what usually happens, hasn't regressed to a pre-evolved state, which most closely resembles a tree, motionless and unresponsive, despite the fact that he had been planted several thousand years prior. Through a long conversation, Mike learns that Garwig was planted because he briefly helped an epidemiologist on a planet that he was studying to finally wipe out a plague that had been devastating her planet's population for a very long time. Mike and Garwig became good friends, each helping the other to not feel so lonely in their lives. Garwig giving stories and advice to the soon-to-be exobiologist, and Mike giving Garwig stories of their society and some companionship. Eventually, just before Mike's graduation, Mike made one last visit to the Garden of Exiles before he would be sent out on his first assignment. Unfortunately, the regression that all exiles undergo had finally caught up with Garwig. His eyes were closed, and his tentacles were as branches. Mike hugged Garwig and told him goodbye. With tears blurring his vision, Mike left the garden for the last time and slowly walked down the path back to the Center for Exobiology. Chapter 2. Graduation. On Erdiu, most regarded a certificate in exobiology as the pinnacle of academic achievement. The curriculum is daunting. It covers genetics, biology, chemistry, biochemistry, astrobiology, cosmology, physics, historical records from 70 million years of field research, and the mechanical and electrical skills needed to be self-sufficient in a spaceship for tens of thousands of years. The Center for Exobiology admitted a new class every century, and 1,000 years later, those students who had completed all 10 blocks of instruction received their certificates in exobiology. As he had done for the previous 21 graduations, Chancellor Berwick presided over the ceremony. He recalled his first meeting with this class. On that day, there had been 15 new students with bright smiles and high ambitions. Today, there were only 3. He told himself with pride that these 3 are the best of the best. From the podium, he commended the graduates for their hard work and challenged them to go forth into interstellar space and bring back knowledge of unexplored worlds. As Berwick continued by thanking parents for their sacrifice, the Institute wasn't cheap, and complimenting the faculty for their dedication, Mike's mind wandered. Garwig, he thought, would have been a great addition to the faculty. He would have brought new ideas and a much-needed sense of compassion. He also wished Garwig could have been here to see him. Eventually, Berwick finished his speech, and he began awarding their certificates of exobiology. Students were called in reverse order of grade point average, starting with the number 3 graduate and then number 2. Finally, the moment Mike had worked for.
And, graduating number 1 in his class, Mikeopoulos, first son of Baekwan and Garbanal of Mosenstrike.
Mike's tentacles flushed pink as he made his way to the podium. Chancellor Berwick smiled and handed him an ornately carved dark wood frame holding his certificate in exobiology.
Congratulations, Mike.
Mike wrapped a tentacle around the frame and said,
Thank you, Chancellor.
He tucked the certificate securely against his trunk and walked back to stand with the other two graduates. Mike's parents attended the graduation and stayed for another day. They talked about what was new in Mosenstrike and what Mike's brothers, sisters, and friends were doing with their lives. Mike took his parents on a walking tour of the campus. It should have been a pleasant and relaxing day. The pressure of final exams was over, and the administrative hassles of graduation were behind him. But Mike's thoughts were a jumble. One minute, he was sad to be leaving his parents, school, and planet. And the next minute, he was excited about his new career, his first assignment, and of course, his first spaceship. The following day, his parents returned to Mosenstrike. His mom gave him a long hug and cried. Mike, too, had tears in his eyes as he hugged his mother. His dad, the owner of an accounting firm and not inclined to emotional displays, nevertheless hugged him and wished him a safe journey. Mike watched until their car disappeared. His parents were past middle age, and he hoped they would still be alive when he returned. Mike walked back to his room, a small, mostly empty box with a bare dirt floor. He had hung color photos of the Andromeda Galaxy and the Orion Nebula on the walls. There was also a 3D glamour poster of Giletta, his favorite actress. Otherwise, there was little to show his room was occupied, just a standing desk and a computer terminal. Mike didn't sit or lay down, so there were no chairs or bed. He didn't wear clothes, so he had no use for closets, wardrobes, or dressers. He absorbed nutrition directly from his environment, and there was no kitchen or pantry, just a bare earth floor in which to sink his roots at night. School was over, and Mike's well-structured life had suddenly lost its structure. Making matters worse, his best friend had become a vegetable, and he had nothing to do until he received his assignment. His thoughts turned inward, and he wrapped all 8 tentacles around his trunk like a blanket. Had he taken the right path? What if he had joined his father's accounting firm? He hated accounting, but it would have been a steady job. By now, he'd be married and have children. That would make his mom happy. And someday Mike hoped to have children of his own. But exobiologists work alone, and they're gone for thousands of years at a time. There would be little opportunity for romance, much less raising a family. Chapter 3. The Library. After spending a miserable half an hour second-guessing himself, Mike realized this was a stupid way to spend his last day on Erdiu, and he wasn't going to be an accountant. Doubtless, his fellow graduates were partying, which was much better than what he was doing. However, he didn't like parties. His social skills were substantially less developed than his academic skills, and parties, paradoxically, left him feeling lonely. Instead, he decided to pay a last visit to one of his favorite places, the center's library. Mike liked to read old books, but not the modern digital versions of old books. He liked to read the original physical volumes. The oldest books in the library were logbooks written by the first exobiologists, some almost 70 million years old. He liked the look of their worn bindings and their physical weight when he held them in his tentacles. He even liked their musty, organic smell. His classmates had made fun of him and called him a casuvib, which is a small insect that eats the pages of books. Mike paid no attention to their insults. He told himself it was simply a sign of their ignorance. The pages of the logbooks were made of a nearly indestructible synthetic fiber, something no insect could possibly eat. The library stored the logbooks in the stacks, a cavernous,
two-story basement containing shelf after shelf of ancient volumes. Mike liked to walk along the narrow aisles, scanning the titles. He wasn't looking for anything in particular, but every so often, a title would catch his eye. He'd pull the book from the shelf, open it to a random page, and start reading. Some logbooks were boring, and he quickly abandoned them. But others were an unexpected delight, a journey through the eyes of another exobiologist into a different world. His walk took him deep into the stacks near the faculty's private carrels. This area had few visitors, and the faint sounds of a conversation surprised him. Walking closer, he recognized one of the voices, his mentor, Professor Ellisbach. Mike was sensitive to the sound of her voice. Not only was she his mentor, but she was smart and beautiful. And yes, he had a crush on her. Later, Mike wished he had ignored the voices. It would have saved him some pain. But when he heard Professor Ellisbach say his name, the urge to eavesdrop became too strong to ignore. Behind the cover of tall bookshelves, Mike edged close enough to eavesdrop on the conversation. He recognized the other voice, and it belonged to Professor Jurgen. Professor Jurgen had never criticized him directly, but whenever they were together, Mike sensed Jurgen's disapproval.
"What planet will you give Mike for his first assignment?"
"I haven't decided. I like Mike, but he is not our usual exobiologist."
"That is very diplomatic of you, Ellisbach. He is far from our usual exobiologist."
"Do you have a suggestion?"
"Something far away and primitive. That way, when he makes mistakes, it won't be a total disaster."
"Jurgen, you're so hard on Mike. He is quite talented."
"I'll grant you the talented part. And he's intelligent, too. But he is not a good fit. Exobiology is a passive profession. We observe and document. Mike is far too eager to take action. He'll be content to observe and document for a few thousand years, but then he'll get bored. Before you know it, he'll be down on the planet making friends with the natives."
"I certainly hope not. But I appreciate your opinion. What about the third planet of M133? The dominant species is intelligent, but quite primitive. They have little potential for development during the next 100,000 years.
It's definitely far away. And who knows, perhaps the experience will mature him."
Mike liked the part about being talented and smart. But hearing that Jurgen thought him unsuited to his profession? Well, that just hurt. He'd finished 1,000 years of study and exams. Why couldn't Jurgen have said something 9 centuries ago? What a jerk. The next day, Professor Ellisbach asked Mike to her office to give him his assignment. During the appointment, Mike feigned cheerfulness and said nothing about what he had overheard. Exobiologists are reserved and discreet. Besides, the only things that truly mattered to him were getting his assignment and leaving Erdiu. There was, he thought, no need to burn bridges.
"Mike, I have a fascinating assignment for you," said Professor Ellisbach. "It's a planet recovering from a catastrophic encounter with a large asteroid. The collision occurred 66 million years ago, and it caused the extinction of most plants and animals, including the large reptiles, which were the dominant life form."
Professor Ellisbach knew his interests lay in the more developed and urban cultures. In her charming way, she was trying to make this backwoods assignment seem attractive.
"The collision changed the environment, and over the next 10 million years, warm-blooded mammals became the predominant form of life. In the last 50,000 years, a bipedal mammal has progressed from hunting and gathering to the beginnings of agriculture and creating small settlements. The center is very interested in their development, and we want you to document their progress over the next 30,000 years.
Mike smiled and said,
"Thank you, Professor."
He also thanked her for all her help and support. However, behind his pleasant facade, Mike's thoughts turned to the typical development cycle for intelligent species. On average, it took 100,000 years for a species to advance from primitive agriculture and small villages to an urban civilization. Professor Ellisbach was sending him to watch farmers and hunters for the next 30,000 years. Chapter 4. The Third Planet of M133. The journey from Erdiu to the third planet of M133 lasted 473 years, which gave Mike plenty of time to get over the disappointment of his assignment and the pain of Garwick becoming a vegetable. He had an extensive electronic library, and he hibernated whenever he wanted, so a trip of this length, while certainly long, was tolerable. When he arrived, he parked his ship at a point in space where the gravitational pull of the planet and its star were equal. This provided him with a stable anchorage reasonably close to the planet. In addition, two asteroids were already orbiting this gravitationally balanced location, and both were bigger than his ship. If the beings on the planet were to develop telescopes and become astronomers, it was highly unlikely they would discover him. But even if they did, his ship would appear to be just another Trojan asteroid accompanying the planet on its journey around the sun. Mike was eager to start work, and quickly found an incredible variety of life. Millions of animals, plants, fungi, microbes, and viruses. For the next 25,000 years, he happily explored, observed, and documented. Some might think he was too far away for detailed observations. However, exobiologists have tools that let them investigate from a distance. Their most versatile tool is a tiny drone, and Mike employed thousands of them. He shaped many of his drones to resemble common flying and crawling insects. His mosquito drones were particularly effective at drawing samples of blood. Drones are more than just tools of the trade. Exobiologists live their lives through them. Without drones, exobiologists are solitary creatures trapped in a hollow rock. With them, they can roam anywhere on a planet, witnessing extraordinary events and listening to intimate conversations. Mike had dreamed about this life, and he felt certain Professor Jurgen had been wrong. He had no interest in visiting the planet, and certainly no desire to befriend the natives. Professor Ellisbach had asked him to focus on the development of a bipedal mammal species. But even if she had not asked, that was where Mike chose to spend most of his time. When he first observed this species, they lived in primitive huts or caves and foraged for food. But they had developed with remarkable speed. Only 25,000 years later, the species now lived in large cities and had built a technological civilization with global commerce, airplanes, and computers. They named their planet Earth and called themselves humans. Professor Ellisbach had taught him that planets are chaotic places of multiple interacting systems. And Mike thought this was true for the Earth. She said the most challenging thing for an exobiologist is identifying and documenting the emergence of the genuinely consequential events in a civilization's history. Mike had asked her how he could tell if something would become consequential. She had replied,
"Intuition."
At the time, Mike did not find her answer helpful. But as the centuries passed and he gained experience, he began to understand what she had been talking about. At first, Mike thought Gautama Buddha was just another itinerant Chinese priest. Buddha went on to found the Earth's most durable religion. Centuries later, Mike took note of Nicholas Copernicus's successful career as a theologian. But he overlooked his unpublished paper, which demonstrated that the sun was at the center of the solar system. More recently, Mike had dismissed Charles Darwin as a dilettante who flitted from one pursuit to another, collecting beetles, digging fossils, and studying geology. He was surprised when Darwin published On the Origin of Species, which became one of Earth's most influential scientific publications. Mike learned from these experiences, and his intuition improved as he learned. When a patent clerk in Germany published a paper on the special theory of relativity,
Mike realized that humans were on their way to developing nuclear weapons. Now, humans were learning to modify DNA, and Mike felt confident this would be consequential. He kept up with the Earth's published research and discreetly observed the laboratories of the largest genetic research companies. Also, based purely on intuition, he included in his observations a small, soon-to-be-open genetics lab, the Matthias Institute. Chapter 5. The Matthias Institute. 75-year-old Warren Matthias was not the typical owner of a genetics lab. For most of his adult life, Matthias had worked on Wall Street. In his previous job, he owned a successful hedge fund. But he did not always follow the rules. A Securities and Exchange Commission investigation forced Matthias to leave the investment business. While he might have been removed from his hedge fund, Matthias was not ready to retire. A polymath, he was interested in everything, from Renaissance painters to scientific research. He also had a rare talent for evaluating new developments and knowing which might become successful businesses. One recent development that fascinated him was a genetic engineering tool called CRISPR-Cas9. CRISPR-Cas9 is short for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats and CRISPR-Associated Protein 9. Matthias was not a scientist and didn't know how it worked. However, he felt that CRISPR-Cas9 was destined to be the next big thing. His research told him that it allowed scientists to cut and paste DNA segments. Since DNA is the foundation of all cellular life on Earth, this would allow geneticists to create more resilient crops, eliminate diseases, and wipe out pests. In addition, Matthias found it was surprisingly cheap. He could buy a CRISPR-Cas9 kit online for $169.99. In scientific circles, CRISPR-Cas9 genetic engineering was popular and getting more so every day. Entering such a crowded field held no attraction for Matthias. However, he had noticed that one aspect of genetic engineering remained unexplored. Human germline engineering, or modifying human DNA so that the modification would be inherited by succeeding generations. This kind of genetic engineering scared scientists and politicians, and they prohibited tinkering with the human germline. Matthias thought this a reasonable fear. Wealthy parents could hire geneticists to make their children more intelligent and more beautiful. Professional sports teams could design their own super athletes. Governments would try to create immortal soldiers. On the other hand, Matthias thought CRISPR-Cas9 had already pulled the cork from the genetics bottle, and he believed the prohibition on germline engineering would collapse from the enormous weight of its potential. When that happened, those who were prepared would be richly rewarded. With the Matthias Institute, he intended to be the first to commercialize the science of human germline engineering. Matthias had one other reason for starting the Institute. He was getting close to the end of his life, and by having a team of geneticists, he hoped they might find a way to let him postpone death. To be successful, Matthias had to hire the right people. He contracted with two headhunters specializing in the genetic sciences, one in Danbury, Connecticut, and one in San Francisco, California. He told neither headhunter about the other. Matthias wanted them to search independently and asked each to send him 12 top-quality geneticists. After the headhunters completed their work, Matthias invited Greg Black, an experienced human resources consultant in New York City, to visit the Institute and evaluate the candidates. Greg drove his red BMW from Manhattan to the Matthias Institute and parked in the nearly empty Institute parking lot. Besides Greg's car, the lot held a silver Lincoln Town Car, a navy blue Volvo, a painter's pickup truck, and an electrician's van. The Matthias Institute was a three-story red brick building with three rows of windows that wrapped all the way around. A grove of mature hardwood trees surrounded the building and parking lot. Greg walked up the concrete steps to the front entrance and opened the door. The entryway was paneled in dark wood, and the floor was dark gray slate. At the end of the entry hall, a middle-aged black woman sat behind a half partition, Greg approached the partition and said, "I'm Greg Black. Are you Mrs. Morris?" Gloria Morris, Mr. Mathias' assistant, stood and greeted him.
"Hello, Mr. Black. Good to see you."
She pointed to the hallway on his right and said,
"Mr. Mathias' office is down the hall, second door on the left. He's expecting you."
"Thank you, Mrs. Morris." In his first phone call with Greg, Mathias had told him to call Gloria to arrange a meeting. He said,
"Gloria runs this place. Without her, I'm a disaster."
Today, like most days, Gloria wore a crisp white blouse and a charcoal gray skirt. Her desk held a computer monitor, a keyboard, and a pen. Her inbox was empty, but Greg's desk was buried in papers, and he hadn't seen the bottom of his own inbox in years. He wondered if he could afford to hire someone like Gloria. Episode 2 is now in the books. How did the story strike you? Mike has finally gone out on his first assignment, even with the reservations that two of his professors had regarding Mike and his tendencies towards encountering new races and species. And we've started to meet a few humans. Warren Mathias does seem rather like our usual eccentric rich man, but there may or may not be some good aspects to him and his activities that may or may not show up in the future. And there was absolutely no hinting or foreshadowing at anything at all in the future. At all. Well, since we don't have much by the way of voicemail or emails just yet, I'll go ahead and sign off. I'll have some more advertising up soon, hopefully later today, if not tomorrow. So you should see more and more information about the show very soon. So until next time, this is Andrew Kaufman, signing out.
If you'd like to share your thoughts about the show, you have many ways to do so. You can send your feedback in text or audio to thegreathuntersnovel@gmail.com, and I'll be happy to read them or play them before the credits. You can also submit it to the website at www.kaufmansci-fi.com. Facebook page for the podcast and myself is www.facebook.com/performer.andrew.kaufman. If you like the book, please leave a review at Apple Podcasts and or podchaser.com. It really helps people to find the show. That's all for now. I'll be back in 2 weeks with a new episode. The book is copywritten 2024 by Gary Kaufman. The intro song is Jet Fueled Vixen by Kevin MacLeod from Incompetech.com and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution 3.0 license. The outro song is Stay the Course, also by Kevin MacLeod from Incompetech.com and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 license. The contents of this podcast are copywritten 2024 by Andrew Kaufman and is released on a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. So don't change or sell it, but you can share it all you want. For more information about these licenses, please visit creativecommons.org.